Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Sparkle Horse is a one-man indie pop band led by singer and multi-instrumentalist Mark Linkous. But the band's songs are as richly textured and highly arranged as a piece of chamber music. Sparkle Horse is also a band that's had to overcome its share of struggles, bouts with depression and substance abuse that are well known to its fans. But the latest album, called Dreamt for Light Years in the Belly of a Mountain, is, as one critic wrote, filled with a ghostly sense of peace. Mark Linkous and bandmates have joined us in our studio and are going to start us off with a live performance of a song called Pain Birds. Here, live on Soundcheck, is Sparkle Horse.
Here come the pain.
That's a live performance by the band Sparkle Horse here in our soundcheck studio. Pain Birds is the name of it, written by Mark Linkus, who sings and plays the guitar. Mark, the new record is called Dreamt for Light Years in the Belly of a Mountain, but this is an older song, right?
Yeah, that's off of Good Morning Spider, the second album.
Well, now, this new record, I mean, you know, for the past couple of years, you actually have been living in the mountains, the Smoky Mountains down in the Carolinas.
Yeah.
Has there been a noticeable impact of your environment on the new record?
Well, I guess it probably took a lot longer to do this record because I moved down there, because I often didn't come off the mountaintop for weeks and weeks at a time. So it took a little longer to record this album. But yeah, I'm not sure. I think I'm not sure if I lived in New York City, if I would still write about the same things or not.
But you did live in New York for a while, right? I mean, you've lived on both coasts.
Yeah. When I graduated from high school in the South, I moved to New York to be in a band, and I lived on Long Island and Brooklyn for a while.
Mm-hmm. Now you're living on top of a mountain.
Yeah.
So when you don't come down from the mountaintop, what are you doing up there? Are you living like a hermit? I mean...
Yeah. Well, there's bears and rattlesnakes. I got trapped in the house by a bear one time. Really, I'm serious.
So there's presumably only one door for in and out of the house, and the bear had barred it.
He was in the back of my pickup truck, and that's what I needed to drive to go to the studio to record. And he was in the.
So he was a clever bear. He knew your means of of egress, and he had it all taken care of.
Yeah,
I understand you almost called this new record "Fear of Pop," but Ben Folds, I guess, had gotten there first. I mean, he has an album.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he has a record called that. Then why did you change your mind? I thought maybe that was why, but...
No, I had no idea.
Yeah.
I thought it was silly. I mean, yeah, it was just silly to be an album title, I think, to live with forever. But, so, I changed it.
Was it your intent to make a pop record?
Not really, although they just kept coming out. Like, some of the songs I had written for It's a Wonderful Life in 2001... Like, I think Shade and Honey was written for that record.
Mm-hmm. Which is the song we were hearing a little bit of before.
Yeah. And that record, I had really specific intentions to have it orchestrated wherever possible, not use guitars, orchestrate the parts that were written on guitars, on symphonic instruments, wherever possible. And therefore, some of the pop songs just didn't work on that record, so I saved them for this record, knowing that my next record would be a little bit more poppy.
Right.
Than my earlier.
A number of people have noted the kind of discrepancy between, I mean, it's been 5 years since the last record, and in between, you know, you've had a lot to deal with, you know, depression, the death of a close friend and stuff. And yet, you know, you have titles like Don't Take My Sunshine Away and See the Light. I mean, are those ironic titles or is that kind of really genuinely felt?
It's genuinely felt. I mean, maybe it might be survival instinct or something, but yeah, that's all genuine.
I mean, you know, we've actually done, you know, shows on Soundcheck in the past about the kind of the myth of the depressed artist, you know, and how that, you know, we have this kind of romanticized image of the depressed artist sitting, starving in his garret, let's say, and just churning out one masterpiece after another. The fact is, it doesn't always work like that, and I guess usually doesn't work like that.
Yeah, it didn't for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. It did for a long time. It was just nothing. I couldn't produce anything for quite a long time.
So is that the reason for the 5 year hiatus?
Most of it. Yeah.
Yeah. We're speaking with Mark Linkus. He is the central figure in the band Sparkle Horse. I mean, you've had secondhand experience with depression too. You did a neat arrangement of a song by Daniel Johnston.
Oh, yeah.
Who people will know, I guess, mostly from that movie that came out, The Devil and Daniel Johnston, about a year or two ago.
Right.
This is a songwriter who has a distinctive voice, and you know, there's a personality to his songs, but what's he's too depressed to really make recordings of any kind of professional quality, right?
I don't know if he's... I was lucky enough to work with Daniel at a time to where I think he was pretty stable, you know, socially. And I don't think it's that he's too depressed that he can't function. I think his mind is just so fast, and a lot of times the way he perceives the universe is kind of like a baby, and it's hard to settle him down and say, no, I played totally wrong chords on that, Daniel. I need to go back and fix it. You know, he just thinks everything is beautiful, right, which is kind of great.
Yeah. How about for you? I mean, did working on, eventually coming down from the mountaintop and working on the new record, was that, you know, was that helpful to you, or did you have to kind of get out of where the place that you were at first to get to the point to be able to make the new record?
I guess a little bit of progress at a time. Like if I completed one song that I thought was okay, then I would get a little bit of confidence, and I guess that was it. I would just attain small increments of confidence until I was able to stick my head above water.
Mm. You mentioned with the 2001 record, a lot of those arrangements were quite intricate. You know, there's like a choir of flutes on one song and a number of strings on another. On the new record, again, you have some really interesting arrangements. And Danger Mouse, the guy behind the Gnarls Barkley Crazy hit, works with you on a couple of tracks here. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? And what does he bring? What did he find in your music that made it seem like he could work with you?
Mutual admiration for the Beatles, really. During that time, the last 5 years, I wasn't really doing anything. I think people were sending me records and CDs that people I might want to collaborate with or just get into. And I really liked that. I think my manager sent me the Gray album.
Which was Danger Mouse melding the Beatles' White Album and Jay-Z's Black Album.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so I listened. I finally got around to listening to that after being in a drawer for 6 months, and I just loved it. And we were on the phone a week after that, and he said, "Don't be surprised if I show up at your studio next week." And he was at my studio next week.
Wow. And the track called Mountains is one of the pieces that he worked with you on. Here's Mark Linkous and the band Sparkle Horse with Danger Mouse and a little bit from the new record called Dreamt for Light Years in the Belly of a Mountain. Little bit from the new Sparkle Horse CD, Dreamt for Light Years in the Belly of a Mountain. We've been speaking with Mark Linkous, and now we'll get to hear him with the rest of the band. Johnny Hott is behind our drum kit, Paula J. Brown playing the electric bass, Chris Michaels was playing keyboards on the first live song. He's going to switch off to guitar, it looks like, for this next one, which is another old song called Spirit Ditch from Sparkle Horse. They're playing live tomorrow at Webster Hall, but playing live for us this afternoon here on Soundcheck.
Okay, this is going to be tough because I've got the flu and it's really high. All right. I want my records back. Motorcycle gas tank that I spray painted black. The owls have been talking to me. Sworn
to secrecy. I woke up in a burnt out basement, sleeping with metal hands in a spirit ditch.
Another live song from the band Sparkle Horse. More surrealist folk rock from Mark Linkus and the band. Their new album is called Dreamt for Light Years in the Belly of a Mountain, and they are performing tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at Webster Hall. To Mark and the rest of Sparkle Horse, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Congratulations on the new record.
Thank you, and thanks for having us.
Coming up in a moment, choreographer Miguel Gutierrez has danced to songs by Interpol and U2. He'll tell us how music inspires his work next.
She don't run through the fields anymore.
WNYC is supported by Carnegie Hall, presenting Michael Tilson Thomas and the New World Symphony, taking a trip inside Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony in a multimedia discovery concert. tomorrow night at 8. Tickets at carnegiehall.org. Cornell Paper and Box Company, for over 60 years, offering thousands of packaging-related items, including paper, tissue, and shipping supplies. More at 718-875-3202 or cornellrobins.com. Music from Japan, featuring music by composer Joji Yuasa on March 3rd and the Junko Tahara Biwa Ensemble on March 4th at Merkin Concert Hall, online at musicfromjapan.org.
Today at 3 on Fresh Air, Terry Gross talks to journalist Lowell Bergman about how the mounting pressure for profits, declining advertising, and internet competition is all affecting the news business. Those issues are the subject of Part 3 of his Frontline documentary, News Wars. Lowell Bergman joins Terry Gross for Fresh Air today at 3. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The 35-year-old award-winning choreographer Miguel Gutierrez tackles simple things in his dance pieces, you know, like the nature of existence and why we're here and who we are. And sometimes he even does it in the nude. Next, starting next Thursday, he'll be doing it in a new work called Everyone, which he and his dance group, The Powerful People, will present at the Abrams Art Center on Grand Street. Miguel joins us here in the studio, and I guess this was a good show for you to be hanging out during. You're a Sparkle Horse fan.
Yes, I am.
And a Rumi fan,
yes,
as well.
Very much so.
But your work doesn't, you know, involve a lot of the traditional dance. There are no dying swans and nutcrackers in your dances. You seem to be after bigger game.
I am after bigger game, yeah. It kind of deals with larger sort of metaphysical questions about the body and stuff like that.
So is dance really the right medium for asking those sorts of existential questions?
I think dance is one of the ideal mediums to answer those questions, because particularly the way the body is sort of represented in culture today, where bodies are so much about selling or about beauty or about, you know, wanting to be something other than who you actually are. And I think dance is one of the few forms where, you know, the distance between you and what's happening is so small, really. You know, you're watching live bodies on stage, and that is such an immediate and distinct connection that you can identify with these people who are engaged in an experience that's happening right in front of you.
There certainly have been dances that have sort of left storyline narrative behind and are just about the abstract quality of movement and stuff. Are you leaning more in that direction? It sounds like you wouldn't be, you know, a storyteller kind of choreographer.
I think I do tell stories. I think I tell sort of stories in the sense that I'm telling stories of cultural stories rather than so much like narrative stories. You know, I'm interested in identifying feelings or emotions that are happening in culture that may not have a voice otherwise.
So you wouldn't actually have your dancers roll across a stage to form a gun behind a screen?
No, I'm definitely anti-Oscar Wayne Coolidge shadow puppet dance. Yeah, yeah.
With all due respect to Palopoulos.
That can be your call,
yeah,
not mine.
Okay. Now, this piece you're doing called Everyone, this, as I understand it, is about the relationship between individuals and communities, larger groups.
Yeah.
And, I mean, how, so is it, let me just ask, how do you do that in dance? Is it as simple as one person over here and the rest of the company over there?
No, I mean, I think the piece is about basically the presence and absence of bodies in relationship to love, in relationship to war, in relationship to sort of the presence of the performer on the stage, the presence of the audience member. I mean, my work has a lot to do with the audience sort of realizing its own presence in the room, you know, and sort of realizing that its presence, you know, that your own presence in the room is part of what's making the performance happen, you know. And I like to bring attention to that contract that exists between the performer and the audience.
So this Abrams Art Center on Grand Street is part of the Henry Street Settlement, but
yes,
it's a very small space.
It's an intimate theater. Well, it's not a very small theater, but the way that we're using it creates a very intimate space, so that the people are really close to the performers for most of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Now, my guest is Miguel Gutierrez. Miguel Gutierrez and the Powerful People are doing this piece beginning March 1st and ending March 11th. You're born here in New York.
Yes.
Raised in New Jersey. Your parents were from Columbia.
Yes, Columbia, South America.
Right, right.
Not South Carolina.
Not, or, yeah,
or university.
Right. So what did they make of your career path when you started down the road to becoming a dancer and choreographer?
Well, I think they supported it insofar as they thought it was like a hobby. I don't think that they saw it as like a real career choice, and I think that they were sort of resistant to me doing that. And then it wasn't until I handed my dad a picture of me with Misha, with Baryshnikov, sitting at a table together that he suddenly was like, okay, you're doing the right thing.
Okay.
It was many, many years later.
So did you have the usual traditional dance training?
No, I mean, I think I started out with doing gymnastics and musical comedy, and then I took a lot of jazz and some ballet when I was a kid. I had sort of like I always call it like a hodgepodge kind of training. And then, you know, I went to college to do different colleges and studied dance at both of those schools. I always wanted sort of like a centralized dance education, but it just never seemed to happen.
Mm. I've seen enough dance to know that this kind of stereotype is just that, a stereotype. But the image many people have is that modern dance is very serious. I mean, like, really somber serious. Yeah. Can you use any of that kind of musical comedy training that you had Is there a way that you can use that kind of stuff to,
when
you're tackling the big ideas that you like to do?
Yeah, my work is basically musical comedy, but for the person who likes to read. No, I think I'm influenced by you know, life. You know, I'm not exclusively interested in aping other forms or in, like, you know, finding a way to turn this form into that form. I'm interested in sort of finding a way to say, okay, life happens and then art happens and there's a link between the two, and how do you make that link somewhat invisible and sometimes make a direct representation of, not so much direct representation of life, but how do you create something that's immediate for people and that speaks to them? Because, I mean, I think the reason people have that impression about modern dance is because they think of it as something they don't get. They can't get it. You know, it's something that it's too elusive and too difficult for them to understand. And I have nothing against things that are difficult. I quite like difficult art. You know, that's part of why I chose dance, you know, or that's why it chose me, I guess. But I actually believe that everyone has a way in towards seeing art, you know, in the same sort of faculties that you use to analyze music or to analyze your favorite television show can be the same faculties that you use to have an experience in relationship to dance.
Well, and for some people, it's the music that's that entry point.
Absolutely.
So how do you go about choosing the music? What happens first? Does a piece of music hit you and you say, oh, I've got to do something?
No, I don't work like that. I work intimately with collaborators on all my projects. You know, the dancers. I've been working with several of the dancers for many years. For this particular project, I'm working with Chris Forsyth, who's a composer and a musician. His primary instrument is acoustic guitar. And I knew Chris through the scene. He plays in PSI with my friends Fritz Welch and Jamie Fennelly. And I had collaborated with Jamie on several projects, with Jamie and Fritz on a project. And for my last project, I didn't have music, and I ended up doing the music myself for the project, creating it myself. And then, you know, this piece, everyone, there was so much this idea of how to expand outward from the last project, which had been so, like, in a way, self-centered and about my own sort of grappling with performing and what performing meant to me. So that it seemed like a logical choice to work with a composer again, you know, and Chris is such an amazing collaborator, and he just seemed the right, like, the perfect choice for it.
So everyone is a truly collaborative work, whereas the previous piece was basically, I mean, that was the one where it was really just you. You weren't even clothed.
No, it's a solo trio show. There were three women in it as well. So it was,
you did your own music.
I did the music for it. Yeah,
your body out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much about, like, what does it mean to be on the stage? That's what I was asking. Yeah. I still am asking the same thing, basically.
Well, but everyone, as you mentioned before, raises sort of bigger issues of relationships between individuals and groups. And the performance by Miguel Gutierrez and the Powerful People opens on March 1st, March 1st through 4th, and 7th through 11th at the Abrams Arts Center on Grand Street. Details on the soundcheck page of our website, wnyc.org. Miguel, very nice to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a thrill to be here.
A little bit from your collaborator in the background,
Chris
Forsyth.
PSI, yeah.
And the performance is, again, opening March 1st here in New York on Grand Street. And that's going to do it for today's soundcheck. Tomorrow on the program, music critic Evelyn McDonnell. She spent her 20s and 30s in the mosh pit of alternative culture and then became a mom. She'll talk about the challenge of setting rules after a lifetime spent breaking them. And tomorrow, singer-songwriter Jesse Sykes and the Sweet Hereafter play live in our studio. Don't forget there are many ways to listen to Soundcheck. You can check out our archives and podcasts on WNYC.org, and you can email us, soundcheck@WNYC.org. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our program produced by Brian Wise, Alicia Abbott, and Allison Lichter. Our senior producer is Gisele Regatow, and our executive producer is Chris Bannon. We had help today from Kevin Oliver and Glenn Luttman. I'm John Schaefer. Join us again at this time tomorrow for the next Soundcheck here at New York Public Radio. Coming up next, it's Fresh Air. Terry Gross talks to journalist Lowell Bergman about how the mounting pressure for profits is affecting the news business. That's part of his Frontline documentary, News Wars. He'll talk to Terry Gross at 3 o'clock.